Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Path to Self-Sovereignty podcast. Today, we're with Craig Stanland. Craig is from the US. Craig, thanks a lot for coming on.
Alex, thank you so much for having me. I've been really looking forward to this.
Yeah, thanks a lot for coming. Can you tell people a little bit about yourself?
Absolutely. So my name is Craig Stanland. I live in Brooklyn, New York. And I've got a little bit of an interesting story. I'll tell you what I do now, and then we can backtrack to how I got to where I am. So I am an author, a TEDx speaker, and a reinvention architect. And what that means is I help people who have hit rock bottom or who just want to start over. I help them reinvent their lives and to create an extraordinary life that they want to live. And how I found myself there is, you know, I'm going to go back to 2012. In 2012, I was an extremely successful sales executive for a very large technology company. I had multiple homes. I drove really nice cars. I wore beautiful watches. I was married to a stunning and amazing, beautiful woman. You know, I was usually number one, two, or three in my company performance-wise in sales. You know, I had, by most standard metrics, I had what most people would consider was it all. But what was going on internally was that I didn't feel worthy of my success. I didn't feel like I was enough. I didn't feel, you know, worthy of my wife. I didn't feel worthy of my success. I was worried at work that somebody was going to consistently find out. You know, I lived in fear that I was going to be found out to be an imposter, that, you know, my success was not mine. Even though I was consistently, you know, in the one, two, or three slot, it would just be paranoid that somebody is going to find out that I'm this imposter. And what happened with the equipment that I used to work, that I used to sell, it became very commoditized. And so the margins on it were slimming. And they were slimming. And my feeling of not being enough and not being worthy and feeling like that imposter, that was actually gradually rising. And I went out and just basically would, you know, I purchased everything I could. I spent like crazy. You know, I had the nice cars. I had the nice watches. You know, I buy my wife a lot of things. I ate at the finest restaurants in Manhattan and Connecticut. And that was my identity. My identity was the things I owned and my ability to purchase them. You know, that's where I found my center. So with my paycheck dwindling, but that not feeling enough, not feeling worthy, transforming slowly over time into a bit of greed and addiction of having to continue to buy those things, created a really bad environment for me. I had worked at this company for 13 years, and I started at the very bottom. And because I started at the bottom, I knew the intricacies of how every single thing worked. So I found this, I don't want to necessarily call it a loophole, but I found an opportunity for me to exploit our partner company's warranty policy for my financial gain. And I basically committed fraud against one of the largest technology companies in the world. And I remember that I'll never forget. I'd worked for that company, like I said, for 13 years. But our biggest competitor had just wooed me away with a really nice pay package. And so I was 2 weeks into this job, and I drove into Manhattan from my home in Connecticut, take the elevator up to the 37th floor. You know, I'm unpacking my laptop bag to get ready for my day. You know, I'm putting the computer out, I'm putting my notebook out. I put my phone on the desk, and I look at it and I see that I have one missed call. And I'm like, you know, I had my phone in my hand the whole time. How did that happen? You know that feeling when you're like, how did I miss that? So I put it up to my ear and I listened to it. And it was the following. It was, Mr. Stanland, this is Special Agent McTiernan with the FBI. We are at your house and have a warrant for your arrest. You need to call us and come home immediately. And we will issue a arrest warrant with the federal marshals. And that was October 1st, 2013. And that is the day that my life completely changed. It was really one of the most shocking, worst days of my life. But, you know, I'm sure we're going to get into it, but there are just so anniversary type of days after being arrested. But that was where it all started.
How did you feel, you know, when you had that call? What was going on inside of you when you had it? Was it just immense fear?
It was immense fear. It was sheer terror. My stomach fell into my feet. For some reason, I felt that everybody, you know, I had the phone up to my ear, but I felt that it was broadcast throughout the entire office. You know, it was about 8:45 in the morning on a Tuesday. So there was about 50% capacity. And like I said, I was only there for 2 weeks. I didn't know everybody's name. They were all strangers. And I really thought it was like a megaphone being broadcast to the entire office. And I thought everybody was staring at me. I thought everybody knew. Just sheer, unmitigated terror.
Well, I can't even comprehend it, to be fair. Did you, so take me through that then. So did you, I'm assuming you just went home?
So it's about an hour drive from Manhattan to my home in Connecticut. So, you know, I take the elevator back down the 37 floors. I go pick up my car in the garage. I was embarrassed that I had told the guy, you know, when he parked the car, how long are you going to be? I said, well, I'm going to work. I'll be 10 hours. And here I am 15 minutes later picking up the car. So I'm embarrassed that I'm picking up the car in 15 minutes. I think he knows. I think the garage guy, the valet knows. So I get in the car, I'm driving home, and I call my wife to see what's going on. And she didn't pick up for about six or seven rings. And those were some of the most excruciating rings that I can remember. And when she picked up, the pain and the fear in her voice, all she said, she didn't say hi, she just said, Craig, what's happening? And I had no answer for her. I had no idea what was going on, which is not to say I knew it had caught up with me, but I didn't know exactly what was happening. This was so out of the blue. I called my father to let him know what was going on. I don't have a criminal attorney on file. So I was thinking, oh my God, I need an attorney. I have a real estate attorney. So I called the office up and I explained what was happening, and they actually had a white collar attorney who worked in their office. So I was able to secure representation. And just driving home for that hour, you know, I made several calls to my wife to try to get more info, to try to get something. And she was not comfortable, obviously, speaking, because, you know, I later found out what had actually happened. Since the FBI had been tracking me for a while, but somehow they missed that I had started my new job. My old job, I used to work out of the house. So they anticipated that I was going to be home. So it was my wife that actually answered the door to 15 federal agents with shotguns, assault rifles, and pistols aimed at her face and her chest. And they handed her the search warrant and explained what was happening. And so while I kept calling home trying to get more information, she didn't feel comfortable speaking because the FBI was going through every single nook and cranny of our home. And when I did get to my community, I lived in a gated community. I go through the gate, go down this road. I take a right-hand turn down the hill to where I lived. The second I made that turn, everything came into view. It was, I can't even remember how many cars there were, the unmarked cars. There were the local police department cars. There was something that looked like a SWAT truck parked there. An army of guys all standing outside wearing those blue jackets with the yellow lettering like you see in the movies.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was driving, you know, probably 5 miles an hour down the hill. They formed a little bit of a line with their bodies to guide me into what wasn't really even a parking spot, but it was, you know, we want you here. They used their bodies to control my car, and they used their bodies to control my opening of the door. There was nothing forceful, but I couldn't swing open the door. I couldn't pop out of the car, not that I was going to. And I get out of the car. They get right in my face. FBI agent guy couldn't have been, you know, any more of an FBI agent. You know, he had the gray suit, he had the high and tight haircut. standing as straight as could be, and just said, state your name. So I replied, Craig Stanlon, turn around, hands on the car. He frisked me, turned back around, frisked me again, empty the contents of your pocket onto the front seats. Another guy comes running over with Ziploc bags and starts putting all my stuff in the Ziploc bags. And I asked, I said, can I please, can I see my wife? No, you cannot see your wife under any circumstances. Why do you need to see her? I was like, well, I want to see her. Is she okay? She's fine. You're not going to see her. Okay. Then, I start looking around at what's happening. And I look and I see one of my neighbors, my neighbor Carl, is peeking behind his curtain at what's going on. And when I make eye contact with him, he ducks back behind the curtain like he was a child that I caught looking at something.
Yeah.
And just adds to the embarrassment. And then the agent with the gray suit, he pulls out the handcuffs. And I look at him and I say, and just for your listeners, and I don't know, you probably can't see just through here, I'm 5'4". I was at the time 135, 140 pounds. I'm not a big guy. I'm not a menacing guy. So I said, please, there's no reason for you to handcuff me. I'm not a threat. He said, it's procedure. We have to. He turned me around and he slapped those handcuffs on me. And the sound of handcuffs and that clicking through of the gears as they come on, that was so raw and real and visceral and painful, the finality of it, and the weight of them. I've never been in handcuffs. They were much heavier than I thought they would be, and it was just a pure state of resignation.
Did you have a serious feeling of regret at that point?
Unbelievable feeling of regret. And if I can backtrack, I should have actually said on the drive home, I knew what I was doing was wrong. When I first started, so my fraud was through my laptop. So it was a series of hitting the enter button and clicking the mouse. And that first time I did it, I will say I didn't know that it was illegal. I didn't know what law that would break specifically, but I knew it was wrong. And my heart spoke up and said, do not do this. And I ignored it. So that whole drive home was regret, because I was like, it caught me. Mm. It caught up to me. And to, answer with those handcuffs behind me, yeah, that was just a pure wave of regret. And again, unmitigated terror, because I did not know what was going to happen next. I had no idea how the judicial system works, because I've never been in it. So I was, am I going to jail right now? Mm. I understand trial and those things, but I don't understand what happens before. And I was panicked that I was going to prison, that I was never going to see my wife. And, my heart, when I said that it told me not to do that, it really chimed in and said, I told you so. Mm. It was an awful feeling.
Yeah. So you've got to that point. So you're at home, they've issued you out the car. I'm assuming they took you straight to a local jail, and then you go on trial and everything. Do you get bail to begin with, or how did it work?
So great question. So they did. They took me to the local, about a half hour north from where I lived, to the courthouse for my arraignment. And from there, we entered the basement of the courthouse. The FBI agents had to lock their guns in the trunk of the car. No guns allowed in the building. We go through just the catacombs of this building. I have no idea where I am. It's just the hum of like an air conditioner going. We come into this room and there are two guys that just look like the last men that on the planet that you want to mess with. One just looks like this badass biker, really tough looking dude. The other dude, total military, with the eyes on shirt and the pressed khaki pants and the high and tight haircut. They were the federal marshals. So I had to get processed, which was, fingerprinting, the mugshot, DNA with the cotton swabs in the mouth, and then, the strip search, which was just dehumanizing and really painful to go through. They, at that point, when I was done through that process, they said, you are now property of the federal marshals. And they started escorting me. I got my clothes back and they started escorting me. And I looked at the guy. I had the military guy. That was the one that I ended up dealing with through all of this. And we start walking through these hallways and I said, where are we going? He looked at me like I was a complete idiot. He goes, we're going to your arraignment. I said, oh, okay. That's where I saw my attorney for the first time. I was completely confused as to, I'm like, oh, okay, I guess that's him. My wife and father had co-signed the $100,000 bail agreement. So I was allowed to leave on my own recognizance and go home.
Right. Okay. Okay. So psychologically, but to give a bit of context, psychologically, were you like a rebellious person? Like as a kid growing up and stuff, did you used to rebel and stuff at school? Or were you like a normal guy?
I was when I was younger, I would say, like you said, a normal guy. I was. And then I did get into a rebellious streak. I definitely was. I wasn't over the top, but I was, you know, I misbehaved. I definitely, you know, and I never got caught either.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I remember going to a party and some of our, you know, we were probably in our early 20s and I'm with my best friend and some of the teachers that we had were at this party. We're all drinking beer. We're all having fun. We're hanging out with the teachers. And, you know, my friend Sean was a real troublemaker. He used to get suspended all the time. And, you know, I was busting his chops in front of the teachers. I was like, yeah, you know, see Mrs. Smith. I was like, Sean was the problem. And she looked at me and she goes, you were every bit as bad as Sean. You just never got caught. She goes, and I don't know how you did it.
Yeah. So on this time, unfortunately, you did get caught. You ended up on bail. How long did you manage to get bail before you had to go to court and whatever else happened?
It's a really good question because, you know, a lot of people don't know how the system works. And I certainly didn't until I was in it. It was, so I made bail, go home. I pled guilty. So I was arrested on October 1st. I pled guilty to one count of mail fraud in mid-January. And then sentencing didn't happen until June 10th of 2014.
Okay.
And then reported to prison August 13th, 2014. So all total, it was about 10 months between getting arrested and actually reporting to federal prison. I know some people hear that and they say 10 months, that's horrible. I was away with some guys who had to wait up to 7 years between getting arrested and actually reporting to prison because of just the nature of their case. They had other people on their case, so it took a long, everybody had to go through their trial before they got to their trial. And, you know, 7 years of limbo. I only had 10 months of limbo, and that was, you know, in the beginning, I didn't know what kind of, I was assigned a pretrial probation officer. And she told me, she said, you know, I'm going to give you a piece of advice. Do not look at anything online about prison. It's only going to scare you. So I didn't do any research. And her just saying that, and what I've seen from the movie and TVs, I assumed that I was going to go to one of the prisons that I see on TV. And like I said before, I'm not a big guy. I was convinced that I was going to get raped and beaten every single day.
Just had a couple of technical difficulties there. We are back. Craig, we were talking about how you felt between getting arrested and bail and actually going to prison. Can you carry on with that?
Yeah, absolutely. Hopefully I'm not being too redundant here, but I just want to reiterate the how scared I was and how filled with fear that I was in between getting arrested and going to prison. You know, I didn't, for those first 5 months, I didn't realize that there was a chance that I'd be going to the lowest security prison that the states has to offer, and that where my safety really wouldn't be a concern. And it was just, you know, to continually think of what was going to happen and not knowing, you know, not knowing. There were one of my pretrial probation officers, I had more than one. One of them said, you know, based on the nature of my crime, his opinion was, he goes, oh, you should probably get probation for this. My attorney was saying that you're probably going to go to jail. you know, just hearing these different views. And obviously I was hoping that what the probation officer said was accurate, not what my attorney was saying was accurate, but just the uncertainty, the pure uncertainty of it all. And it all came down to that June 10th, my sentencing date. I'd already pled guilty. So I arrived at the courtroom, and the victim, one of the world's largest technology companies, you know, they went up, they did their piece. Then my attorney did his piece, and I just was sitting there in such a daze. It was surreal, you know. I was just completely overwhelmed, and just knowing that my life rested in the hands of what was happening in front of me, and I had no control over any of it. I had, you know, some people, I think when they go through stress, they start eating a lot and they gain a ton of weight. And then there are other people that the stress just eats away at their body. That was me. So when I was arrested, you know, I said I was 135, 145 pounds or 140 pounds. I went down to about 110. I graduated high school at 115 pounds. So I was 5 pounds less than I graduated from high school. Stress just ate away at my body. To the point that my attorney, when he was speaking on my behalf, he actually said, "Your Honor, look at what it's done physically to my client. Look how," he basically said, he said, "look how awful he looks and how sick he looks." You know, and I understood what he was doing, but at the same time, I was like, gee, thanks. But, you know, it was just, I was weak because I was so stressed and I had lost so much weight. And my attorney, his advice was, because of the financial nature of my crime, he said, you don't want to show up at court looking like a fancy man. You don't want to look like you make a ton of money.
Yeah.
He said, buy the cheapest pair of shoes that you can find, you know, the cheapest black suit that you can find. So I did that. And, you know, these shoes, these cheap, horrible shoes, these $20 black shoes, they're killing my feet. I'm weak from weighing 110 pounds. It was just, all of it was just weighing on me. And, you know, the prosecution did their side, the defense did their side, and the judge recused herself to chambers. I was just sitting in that courtroom knowing that everything rested on what was happening in that room that I couldn't see. And when she comes back out, courtroom's completely quiet. You know, everybody stands. She gives the order for everybody to sit except for the defendant. So I stood there in front of her and I couldn't understand a word she was saying. There was so much legalese. Some of it was coming through. My friends and family were able to write letters on my behalf, you know, to, as part of my defense. You know, he's a good guy. He contributes to the community, you know, whatever they said. And she was holding the letters and she said, you know, these, Mr. Sandlin, these letters show that you're a good man. She said something like, you know, I think you do good so that you can get away with the bad. And I immediately was like, oh, this is not good. And if I remember correctly, I swear she said, you're a bit like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I said, oh my God, this is not going to be good. And she went back to the legalese that I couldn't understand. And then the gavel came down. And I remember looking at my attorney. I looked up at him and I said, was I just sentenced to prison? And he looked at me like he was so confused. He goes, you just got 2 years of federal prison. And I just nodded my head and said, okay. You know, I went home. You know, my wife and I had one of our many arguments as a result of all of this. You know, I lied to her. You know, I lied to her through the whole thing. She would continually ask me, is this okay? Is this okay? And I'd say, yeah, stop asking me. I would get annoyed, you know, with her. Like, why are you bothering me? I got this. And it just, going home after getting a 2-year prison sentence and, you know, my wife just being devastated, you know, completely devastated. The ground beneath her feet had completely disappeared. You know, her husband, the person that she loves, was going to be going away, but he also lied and betrayed, you know, what I think is that sacred trust in a relationship and in a marriage. You know, it was just that trust. And I had about, so that was June 10th, and I reported to prison on August 13th. So I had 2 months. We had 2 months to basically get our entire life organized, you know, for 2 years in 2 months. And it was just so chaotic to try to fit that in. My wife could not afford our home, you know, without my salary. She couldn't afford my home. She had just launched a new business. So it was, you know, still shaky and still, you know, not on solid ground. So we had to find her an apartment. We had to get her business, like, you know, try to get her business up and running to a point of sustainability so she could keep a roof over her head and food in the fridge, you know, all of this in 2 months' time. And it was just, it was chaotic. And those 2 months went by really quickly. Reporting to prison came up really, really fast.
I can imagine. Yeah. So, because it's very difficult for anybody who hasn't been in that situation to understand how, like, psychologically, you'd be able to handle still being in the world, knowing that you're going to be locked away from it for a couple of years. Can you act normally? I use that term loosely, but can you act normally in that time, or have you always got that knowing that you know, you're not going to see the people that you love for a couple of years or very infrequently? How do you act different?
It was, you try to act normal, you know, you try, but that dark cloud doesn't disappear. You know, I was told that I'd be going to the lowest security and that my safety shouldn't be a concern, but I didn't know what that meant. I still knew I was going to prison. So I still had that. Everything that you said about family and friends and the life that I knew, all of it had completely disappeared and not seeing it to you. So you try to act normally, but what does that mean? And it was such a strange feeling. I felt from the moment of my arrest, you know, all the way through, I felt like a ghost. I felt like everybody could see through me. I became very uncomfortable with eye contact. You know, I did this trick where I would look at, you know, the tip of the left ear of whoever I was speaking to. So it looked like that I was looking at them. You know, I thought it looked like I was looking at them in the eye, but I couldn't. It was either the ear or a spot on the wall behind them.
Was that the imposter syndrome, like, still, was it manifesting itself at that point? Do you think that was the same, similar thing?
I think it was imposter syndrome. And I also think it was, or I know it was pure shame. It was pure shame that I had betrayed the voice that told me not to do it, and embarrassment. You know, it made the local news. It made all the newspapers, you know, so my neighbors knew, plus, you know, with the 15 cop cars there, it was hard to keep that a secret, but it was just that shame. It was just pure shame. And I felt like everybody, like I said, you know, trying to live a normal life. So we'd, you know, go fill up the car with gas and I hang the guy and I feel like he knows, you know, just like every single person knows that I'm a federally convicted felon and that I'm going to prison. You know, it just ate me alive. And I just tried to live as normally as possible, but it's impossible.
Yeah. Is there like anything that you couldn't do? So obviously you can't leave the country or anything like that, but is there anything like that we take for granted that you can't do at that point?
At that point, yes, there was. I couldn't cross state lines without letting them know that I had crossed state lines. You know, it was easy, but it was interesting. You know, all I had to do was shoot a text. So it wasn't that bad. Mm. But, you know, as soon as I was crossing the line, I said, I'm in New York now. I'm back in Connecticut. You know, I'm going, and my wife's business involved a lot of driving. She had a vintage furniture business that she was launching. So that involved going to a lot of flea markets and a lot of estate sales and driving. You know, we lived in the tri-state area, so we drove through the tri-state area. And, you know, there was just a lot of texting, and there was those moments of, you know, if I was in a new state for a minute and I forgot to text, of just sheer panic that, you know, the helicopters and the satellites up above know where I am, which is completely not true, but just that, you know, oh my God, I'm going to get even in more trouble. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, I got to text them right now. And yeah, it was, that was pretty much, I'm trying to think, that was the only thing in that part that freedom-wise that I lost.
Yeah. Okay. So now, was it August you said you were to go to prison?
Correct, August 13th.
Okay, so walk us through that.
That was my father and stepmother picked us up early in the morning and drove us to federal prison. And I'll never forget, it's funny, my stepmother, I love her dearly, but she's got a lead foot. So I look at the speedometer. At one point, she's doing close to 90 miles an hour. And I'm whispering in the back of my head, I was like, who races to prison? This isn't where I want to race to. Why are we speeding to prison? And we the prison I went to is Otisville Federal Prison, which is about 2 hours north of New York City. It's in the middle of nowhere. It's on top of what's called One Mile Drive. And One Mile Drive literally is a 1 mile drive up this mountain, you know, weaving its way all the way to the top of this mountain. And I was going to what's called a federal prison camp. And most camps are tied to a higher security facility, usually a medium security facility. When we drive up, we see the signs for the camp. So we pull into the camp and we were immediately told, no, you have to go to the medium. And it was, wait, what do you mean? Because I'm supposed to be going to the camp. Medium security facility is, you know, filled with the murderers and the rapists and, you know, hardcore gang members and just violent offenders. And it's like, no, you have to check in at the medium security facility. So we pull out of the camp and we drive, you know, a couple more twists and turns, and we pull into the parking lot to see this medium security prison, which is exactly what you're probably envisioning it is. It's two sets of 30-foot high fences with razor wire on top of them. You know, if somebody were to miraculously make it over one, they still have another fence to contend with. The guard towers every 100 feet or so. And it was just intimidating, and it imposed itself on the landscape. My stepmother, when she pulled in the parking lot and saw it, she turned around. She said, she's like, you're not going in there. I said, I don't have much choice in the matter. So my wife and I said our goodbyes to, or I said my goodbyes to my father and stepmother out in the parking lot. And my wife accompanied me to the lobby of the medium security facility. And it was almost like checking into a hotel. It was bizarre, you know, except they were behind this fishbowl security desk that was all bulletproof glass. You know, can I help you? I'm checking in, you know, last name Stanland. Have a seat, we'll be right with you. So my wife and I sat there and we held hands and we cried, and the guard came out and said, Stanland, Craig, it's time to go. Say your goodbyes. And we hugged and we kissed, and I watched her leave through the door as I was walking into the prison. That was really hard. And they took me through the catacombs, through the basement of this facility. It was so bleak. Everything was gray and white and just fluorescent lights and very little noise, because everything was behind all these cinder block walls. And it was like a ship going through the Panama Canal, where we would come up to one door and you would unlock it with these ridiculously large skeleton keys and say, wait here, unlock the door, walk through, wait there, lock the door behind them. And we just did that series after series of doors, and finally ended up in a holding facility. We come up to a small cell, and he opened up the door, looked at me, looked at the cell, you know, didn't say a word, and I understood what that meant. And I crossed the threshold into that cell, and he just slammed the door behind me. And, you know, before I said the handcuffs, the sound of the handcuffs was so visceral and raw. Well, so is the prison cell closing behind you. That was, I mean, it just reverberated through my heart, through my being. There was a toilet and a wooden bench, and I just sat there and put my head in my hands and just no idea what was going to happen next.
So you were in the medium prison here, and they had to move you, or did they walk you to that?
This is It's a great question because it's one of the most surreal moments. So they did the same in the it's receiving R&D, receiving and departure is what they call it. So they did the same thing that the federal marshals did to me. They did another DNA test, fingerprints, mugshot. I got my prison ID card. They gave me my temporary clothes and something that I later found out what the guards do to have a little bit of fun. Like I said, I was, you know, at the time, 110 pounds. And I'm standing there naked because they had done the strip search. And the guy looks at me and says, "What size are you?" I'm like, "Really? You know, I'm a small." And I watch as he just gets a big grin on his face and he reaches to the upper right and grabs double XL. Double XL pants, double XL shirts, you know, gave me a belt that was, you know, I mean, felt like it was 10 feet long. I mean, it was just, you know, I'm sitting here swimming in my clothes. And I actually had gotten checked in with somebody else who was going to the camp. So the two of us are sitting there, both, you know, paranoid. They hand us our bedrolls, you know, pillow and our blanket. They walk us all the way back through that maze and back out through the front door that my wife and I had originally walked into. And this is the surreal part. The guard, he says, "Do you see that rock up in the distance?" I said, "Yeah, we see that rock. Walk up to that rock and take a right. You'll be at the camp." And this guy and I look at each other and we look at him and I was kind of shaking my head a little bit like, "No, I'm not doing that." And he goes, "Just stay on the path. You're not going to get shot. It's fine." And it literally, you just walk from one prison to the other. And this guy and I were chatting like, this is so weird to us that they just did all of that. And now they're allowing us to walk. And like I said, I was very fortunate to go to that prison because there were no fences. We literally could just walk right in. And the moment that you walk in, I have to say something really, really nice. Everybody comes up to you and says, "What's your name? Do you need anything? How can I help you?" And just welcome you with open arms. And I was assigned a mentor. Everybody's, you know, assigned another inmate to walk you through everything. And I had this gentleman in his mid 60s who was in for a $60 million Ponzi scheme. And he was really a great guy and just took me under his wing and, you know, showed me everything. And it was getting the phone set up so I could make phone calls, getting my email set up. They gave me the inmates because the prison doesn't supply this and you can't bring your own toiletries. So I later found out there's a system where they create a kit for new people coming in with your shampoo, conditioner, soap, toothbrush and toothpaste and shower shoes, you know, and everybody comes in. And once as an inmate, you're in for a little bit and you've got your money situation sorted out with commissary, you make sure to give back to the system for the next person that comes in. You know, you make sure to contribute to the next person, which I thought was really nice. When I realized, you know, at one point I looked over, there was this massive dude, you know, 6'3", 265 of solid muscle. I mean, just, this guy was built like a house. And there was a cat on the sidewalk and this massive man is rubbing his belly and just talking to this cat in like a baby voice. And when I saw that, I don't know why I looked at that, but I said, "I'm going to be safe here because that cat feels safe here." That actually was what I was thinking. I was like, that cat is exposing its stomach to this, you know, giant guy. And this guy's talking to it like, you know, like I talk to babies sometimes, you know. And it was just, I realized I was going to be safe when I saw where I was. And I slept really well that night. It was unbelievable because that 10 months of sheer terror, when I realized I was going to be safe, I was still scared because I didn't know what happened next. But I slept really well that night.
Yeah, yeah. And the guy that you walked to the place with, did you stay friends with him?
I did. He was only there. He only had a 2-month sentence.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he only had a 2-month sentence. He was a very nice gentleman. But we did stay in touch. I think when you go through something as traumatizing as that, you know, it was very easy for us to stay bonded for that 2 months.
And was it obviously you call it a camp or whatever it's called? I don't know what that would be called over here. I've never heard it called anything like that over in the UK. Like, is it secure to the point that, you know, your cells are left open or are they closed and locked? Is it like what you see on television, or is it completely different to that?
It is. It's different from that. We had, they were cubes. So it was basically almost like an office cubicle, except the cubes were made out of concrete cinder blocks that were about, I would say, 5.5 feet to 6 feet tall with open doors. They didn't even have doors. They just had an opening. And it was a bunk bed, so two guys per cube, probably measured about 8 by 12, 8 by 13, give or take. So we had the bunk beds. We each had a small foot locker. We each had about 5 hooks that we could hang our clothes on, and these little plastic stools that looked like mushrooms. It was pretty much, you know, all that was allowed, and you couldn't decorate. You know, you had to keep everything very tidy. You had to make your bed every morning. Otherwise, they would come in and they would literally tear your cube apart. The camp administrator would come in and rip your mattresses, throw them in the hallway. I mean, throw all, empty your lockers out, dump all your stuff all in the hallway. So you had to keep everything very tidy.
Okay. And what would an average day look like?
Average day, prison is all about routine. You know, I found that out, that people were like, in the beginning, they said, just settle in, you know, you're safe, so that's good, but settle in and find your routine. My routine ended up being, I would get up at around 5:45, brush my teeth, you know, go to the bathroom, do all that stuff. I would make my coffee. We had powdered coffee and powdered cream. So I would make that, and I would go to the prison library, where I would started journaling and just reading and meditating. You know, I would get there. I liked getting up that early because nobody was in the library, so I could meditate first thing while it was still quiet. And I journaled for a while, and then if I was working, I got assigned to the kitchen. So I worked 3.5 days in the kitchen. So there were some days where I would go to the kitchen. When I was done with work, you know, in the beginning, it was all about, there was so much pressure I put on myself that I knew that I was wrong. And I knew that I had to, like, I had to fix this. I had to make it right. So I did a lot of self-development, you know, but it was not necessarily the healthiest, because it was like, I'm looking for that silver bullet that was going to make everything okay, you know, and there is no such thing. So I really just diligently read and worked on myself, but to the point of really burning myself out. We had a gym, so I was actually able to work out. I used to be a personal trainer in my 20s. And when my fellow inmates found that out, I actually got hired to train people. So I had clients, you know, they would have their family send money to my commissary account so I could buy things on commissary. And that was really nice, but it was, you know, very regimented. And we're also in prison counted several times throughout the day, which also helps build a structure. I think it's a 10 a.m. count, standing count. So you have to, wherever you are, you have to stand, you know, wait for them to count you. You have to wait until the count is clear. You know, there was 117 of us. You know, they had to make sure that all 117 were accounted for, and then the count is clear. So it was 10 a.m., 4 p.m., 10 at night, and then throughout the evening, but they would count you on your bed for those late ones. So it was very structured, and that really helped pass the time. Mm.
So tell me, did you meditate and journal and do all this stuff before you went in, or was it that the trigger point to start?
That was the trigger point. I had always wanted to meditate before going to prison, but I always made the excuse that I didn't have enough time. And, you know, that's not an excuse in prison. There's more than enough time. So I started that practice then, and something I still do to this day. Mm.
Mm. So was there any like times in prison where it got really difficult and you wanted to just give it all up? Or was it like I don't really want to use the term holiday, but was it that bad?
It was. So there's two definitive answers for that, actually. So where I was completely safe. It was completely, the people were so interesting. You know, I met some of the most interesting guys that I've ever met. The landscaping was actually, to be honest, it was pretty. And they do that for the people who visit. They want to make it look good for the visitors. but we had picnic tables outside. When the weather permitting, we're eating lunch and dinner outside. You know, we're surrounded by woods. My physical location was really great, all things considered. The physical prison was not bad. The mental prison that I had put myself in, that is where my hell was. You know, I was so grateful that I was where I was, but I was so consumed by shame, and I was so consumed that I ignored that voice that told me not to do it. And that voice, every time I clicked that mouse button, every time I hit the enter key, that voice chimed in. And when I realized that I had hit the million-dollar threshold on my crime, my heart actually tightened up like I was having a heart attack. It gripped me and it stopped me. I remember I was taking clothes out of my dryer and it just froze me. And I was like, stop doing this. I mean, you know, that voice, it spoke with words, it spoke in physical manifestations, and I ignored it and it went away. My heart literally locked itself in my chest and I felt so empty and so hollow and consumed with shame that I knew better and that I had hurt the woman that I loved. And it was on December 22nd, so I was in prison for just over 4 months, where my wife came and visited me. And I could see something in her eyes. You know, we're sitting in the prison visiting room. It was right before Christmas, so the visiting room was packed. You know, it was just, we're surrounded by people, tons of conversations. And I saw it in her eyes, and I kept digging, and I kept digging, because I knew there was something there. And I'd felt it for a few weeks. You know, it's kind of the sword of Damocles, you know, hanging by a thread over my head. And she just finally came out and she said, I'm leaving you. And that really, there's so many different markers going through this experience. That was one of the, you know, every time I thought the bottom would come out, you know, a little bit more, there was always just another fall. And that was a really big fall. That was a really painful one, to know that I had done that to her and that I knew better and that I had lied and that this was all my fault. You know, that voice went away, but here I am. You know, I'm alone with the man who did all this and just the self-loathing. So after she told me that, it really went downhill from there. You know, I was still meditating and still trying to journal, but my journaling was, you know, filled with pure self-loathing, you know. And it was just journaling basically, you know, that I hate myself. And finally on New Year's Day, or just a few days after that, I wrote, and this is actually how my TED Talk starts, but I wrote something in my journal that basically started with, I can't shake the image that 2015 is going to be the image of the year I put a bullet in my head, is how the journal entry started. And I can't tell anybody because I'm filled with shame. I want to share with somebody, but you know, I'm pretty sure this is the year that I'm going to kill myself. And you know, we spoke about meditation, and I know from listening to some of your stuff, you're familiar with the term the monkey mind, you know, and the monkey just throwing vision after vision and picture after picture and thought after thought until one of them sticks. Well, it showed me what my own suicide would look like. And it was in such graphic detail that I was in one of the basements of one of the houses that I owned. And I walk in from the right side of the room, and I'm watching this as if I'm, you know, sitting at home and on a TV, like it's on a screen. And I'm wearing a black hood over my head. Even with that black hood, I know it's me. I can feel it. And I sit on this chair right beneath a window that's in the basement. And I pull out a pistol, and I don't know where it was hidden. And I place it in my mouth. And to this day, I can still taste that cloth, and I can still feel the cold steel of the barrel. And I pull the trigger, and I can feel the bullet exit through the back of my head. And as I watch the scene, I can see my brain and skull fragment on the wall behind me, and my body slumps forward. So the monkey, you know, showed me that vision a couple of times. It started when I was meditating, you know, and I shook it off. And eventually it just became on a permanent loop for 4 months straight, where it seemed as though every second of every day was consumed with this video on a continual loop, and I couldn't shake it off. And it was just getting, it was driving me mad. It was driving me literally insane to the point, you know, when I would, at that 10 o'clock count, I used to go to sleep right after the 10 o'clock at night count. And I, you know, you don't cry in prison, you know, you don't want to be that guy. So just held it all inside. And I put my head on the pillow. And the whole accumulation of the day of that video replaying would just hit me like a ton of bricks as I was waiting for sleep to come. And I would just pray. I would just say, please make it stop. Please make it stop. You know, I hope you don't mind that I use this word, but this is literally what I said. I mean, I said, I would beg and say, please make it fucking stop. You know, please, I want to die in my sleep. Please, can I die in my sleep? You know, do me a favor. And every morning when I woke up, I was disappointed when I would hear the sounds and I would see the light of a new day, because I knew I just had to face, and that video started on replay again and just got really bad. And it was so strange, because back to your point, I knew where I was fine, but it was just that mental prison.
And you still had 16, 17 months at this time in prison?
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
So was that always playing on your mind as well? I've still got this long left and I feel like this. I don't think I can handle it.
Exactly that. It was exactly that. And I couldn't share with anybody. I couldn't share on the phone because calls are recorded. I couldn't share through email because emails are monitored. I wouldn't tell any of my fellow inmates. If you mention suicide in prison, you get locked in solitary confinement. And that scared the absolute hell out of me. So I couldn't risk that. So I had to keep it all bottled in. And, you know, it turns out that I ended up getting 3 months off for good time. Part of my sentence was actually in prison. The other part was in a halfway house, you know, which is literally the halfway point between prison and coming back to the real world. So I didn't, you know, but I didn't know any of that. So to your point, I really did think there was that 16, 17 months and I couldn't see the light at the end of the tunnel.
But you're here talking to me. So something happened.
Exactly right. It was, you know, I when I think about it now, I really think that the universe stepped in and did me a favor. It was, like I said, prison's all about routine. And routine dictated that I check my email at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So I check my email and there's one unread message from my best friend, the guy I mentioned earlier, Sean, the troublemaker. And he said, hey man, I'd like to come visit you this weekend. Is that cool? I said, yeah, you can absolutely come visit. The visiting room's not monitored. Sean has been my best friend for over 30 years. He's a guy I trust my life with. I knew I could share it with him and at least get this pressure off of my chest and off of my shoulders to share with him that things are not okay, that I'm, you know, Sean, it's got to the point where I'm planning on killing myself. You know, just to tell somebody that would be such a relief. So it seems to take forever for Saturday to come, but it finally does. And we sit down. Sean buys us some microwave cheeseburgers from the vending machine. Oh my God, are you kidding? Those were like such a treat compared to prison food. Oh, they were such a treat. It was a luxury. It was an absolute luxury. I had a root beer and a microwave cheeseburger was such a treat for us. You know, we sit down and I cannot tell you how excited I was to get this off of my chest, to get it out of me. I open my mouth to speak. And before I can even utter a word, Sean starts to speak. His life's a mess. He's getting a divorce. He's got work issues and money issues. And in that moment, it dawned on me that Sean drove, I think, 2 hours to come to federal prison because he needed his friend. And that feeling of unworthiness that I mentioned before and not being enough and feeling that worthlessness, at that moment, I realized I had value and that I had worth as a human being and nothing more, as being a friend. And that was the moment that my life changed again. The day of my arrest was the day that my life changed for the worse. And that was the day, you know, when Sean visited me, that was the day my life changed for the better. That was the second part of my journey because I realized that I had worth. I had nothing to do with my property or possessions. And it was that night when I went to sleep, I didn't pray to die. I wasn't, you know, wasn't like an instantaneous, I feel great type of thing, but it was, I wasn't disappointed when I woke up the next day. And that really started everything.
So you know, for clarity, because your friend had come to you and needed you as a sounding board, you felt that you had some value in the world at that point, which changed everything that was going on between your ears.
Absolutely, because I really did feel completely worthless. And part of that worthlessness, it bears to note, because of what I had done to my wife. I know that my wife truly loved me. She didn't love me because of the things or the lifestyle or anything like that. If we were poor, she would have loved me.
Yeah.
And I really believe that love is the greatest gift that we have as part of our human experience. I think it's magical. It's what makes being alive so special. And I destroyed that. And that's a lot of what I would journal on, was I destroyed that. So I believed that I would never be worthy of love. I never believed I'd be worthy of anything. And I thought that I was completely worthless because of all of that. What I had done to what I think is the greatest gift that life has to offer us, I threw it away and destroyed it. So why would I be worthy of anything? And therefore, why would I be worthy? I became worthless. So Sean's visit showed me that I did have worth. He could have spoken to anybody. He didn't have to come to prison to speak to me, but he needed his best friend. And it really did change everything. And then my mom and my aunt came the very next weekend. My mom flew up from North Carolina to go to my aunt's home in Connecticut, and they made the long drive themselves to come see me. And I think was just reinforcing the universe's message of, you have worth and you have value. You know, you're needed here. And that really...
So those prayers that you were going to bed were answered through your friends and your family. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. And I've had somebody say to me, thank God your prayers didn't come true of dying in your sleep. And I said, I think about that a decent amount, where I am very, very, very fortunate.
It's, yes. Reframing that, I'd look at death has a different, I don't see death as a physical death as such. It's like the death of, the relinquishment of your mental state and everything. That's more of a death to me than the physical death. So
I think that's brilliant.
Yeah. I would agree that you died. It just depends which way you're looking at.
And I didn't at the time. It was when I started doing a lot of the deep inner work where I realized that it was, I think it was a bit of an ego death, because my ego and my identity was so rooted in all of my things. And when it was all stripped away and I had no idea who I was, other than the man who destroyed everything. And I think it was certainly a form of death. And, what has come from that, from those visits and for the, past 6 years has just been the rebuilding and reinventing of my life, of just doing that deep inner work to, find out, who I am. And realize that it's not our property. It's not our possessions. It's our ability to connect with one another. It's not to sound cliche, but it's what's inside.
Yeah. And that's the problem. It is cliche, but it's true.
I mean, cliches, a lot of times they exist because they're true.
Yeah, sure. And very often we need to hit rock bottom in order to, and which I know you mentioned, you hit rock bottom, you coach people from that point. And I think that's, you can't go any further anyway. So you may as well start at that point. Do you know what I mean?
I totally know what you mean, but I know some folks who've gone through the system and gone through some similar things, and it is a choice, and it's a very powerful choice. I called it the burnt ashes of what was, and, a very much Phoenix kind of, parallel. But I think it's a choice. You can stay in the burnt ashes of what was, of what your life was. You can stay there, and, eventually I think that regret would just turn into bitterness and anger and living a very small, bitter life. And, it's a choice to step out of the burnt ashes of what was and to accept, I had to, I realized now with the work that I'm doing, there were three very critical steps that started the rebuilding process. I didn't realize it at the time, but now, putting it all together, there were three very important pieces. And the first one was accepting reality. And that was, you know, when I was in prison, you know, shocking, I was wishing that I wasn't in prison. You know, I was wishing I was anywhere but prison. I was wishing I was home with my wife and with my cat and my dog on my couch. And I was wishing I didn't make the choices I was made. I was wishing for anything other than what reality was. And one day I just said, I can't do this anymore. I'm fighting against something that I will never win. I am in prison. I am a federally convicted felon. I am divorced. I literally wrote it all out. I accept all of this. I accept I made the choices that I made. I accept that I betrayed my heart. And when I did that, I actually felt a bit of freedom inside of prison. You know, that was number one. Then it was number two was accepting responsibility. And it was accepting responsibility that I did break the law, that I did hurt my wife and my family, and taking extreme responsibility for it. You know, there was, through the whole process, the FBI made a couple of errors. The prosecutor said something wrong. He got one of my financial figures wrong at my sentencing. And, you know, I used to sit there and be like, oh, I shouldn't be very victim role. You know, they said things that were wrong. They did all of these things. Until one day when I said, if I didn't hit that enter button, the prosecutor would have never had a chance to misstate that number in court. The FBI would have never made a mistake on their report. I knocked the first domino down. And, you know, looking at it now, prosecutor just made a careless mistake. He wasn't being malicious. I know where he got that number from. It was a report that was supposed to be thrown away. And, you know, I guess it didn't. So it was just a mistake. It wasn't malicious. And that mistake would have never happened had I not knocked the first domino down. And then that accepting responsibility transformed not only into for actions I had done, but it turned into accepting responsibility for my life now. You know, I remember writing myself a question. Okay, this is my life now. What am I going to do with it? And that, again, was a little bit of freedom inside prison. It was like, okay, I choose to step out of those burnt ashes. I choose to do something with this. And then the third one is accepting choice. And it was accepting that I have that choice to give meaning to this suffering that I caused myself, that I caused my wife, that I caused my family. And to, again, I can't reiterate enough, just to give meaning. You know, I mean, that was so important. And that was a choice, and understanding the power and the freedom that is in choice, and that everything in life is a choice. And those were the first three steps that I took to really start rebuilding my life.
Mm. I think that's very powerful, particularly becoming objective to life is one of the major steps that I found in my life, rather than fighting it and just letting it happen a little bit. Even just relinquishing, if you're unhappy at work, just accept that you're unhappy at work rather than fighting the work. And the peace that you get from inside of yourself is exponential. It just explodes.
It really does. So you felt peace. Did you feel when you went through it, was it, for me, it was a weight off my shoulders. Mm. You know, it was liberating. It was freeing. Yeah. And you felt peace? Did you feel anything else?
Or? I think you sound like we're talking about the same thing, maybe just a semantics thing.
Yeah.
But it was, it's as if like a weight lifts off your shoulders. Yeah, but it becomes like, rather than being linear, which is from there to there, it become non-linear. So it sort of just opened up. It was as if a new world had opened. Very difficult to put into words.
No, I think you just did a brilliant job of it. I think that was a phenomenal explanation of it. That's exactly right, because it opens up the world, and it really, I would say, is also its presence. Mm. You know, here I am wishing that I had made different choices, so I'm living in the past. Wishing that I was, you know, at home on the couch, that would be something in the future. You know, I was anywhere but the present. And when you come to the present, it does open up that world of opportunities and possibilities. Yeah. Present may not be what we want. You know, mine was federal prison. It may not be the ideal situation, but I had what I call it as at a baseline, at a starting point. You know, I had actually somewhere I could start over from.
Yeah, yeah. And you mentioned self-ownership, completely owning everything that you've ever done.
Absolutely.
Because there's nobody else that you can blame at that point. And it's just so empowering. You're like, yeah, I've got full control here. over my own existence, you know.
That is, it was one of, and, you know, I'm curious about you, if you feel like it's been like layers of an onion for me, where, you know, accepting that ownership, it goes deeper and deeper. It doesn't seem to almost have an end. And I think it's really powerful. And the amount of freedom that is found there.
The self-discovery process, I think that is it. It's the peeling the layers of the onion. And once you get rid of all the layers, you always end up at the same place, which you can't express into words, but it's like, there's nothing left.
Right.
We've created the rest. You take them all off and there's nothing there. And it's easy to, because it's all, this is why metaphors work so well, because people can start putting things in their own psychology. But the layer of the onion is a great analogy, because everybody realizes that they've got their own conditioning and everything. And when those onions are peeled off, those layers are being peeled off, what's left is nothingness as a rule.
Right.
And that's, if you operate from there, like there's nothing like riots in the streets and whatever else. It doesn't tend to affect you, because it's like, I'm operating from that centered point. I don't know if you feel the same way.
I do. And I'm just sitting here in awe, because I love how you actually express that, because it articulates how I feel. And I, you were right. It's very hard to articulate, but you just did it. You know, as I've done this work, I sometimes I'm like, what is this that I'm feeling? And it's pure equanimity and peace. And so I'm very grateful for that. But, you know, and trying to put it into words, you just nailed it. So thank you.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I appreciate that. So let's go back to prison. So we were, you saw your friend. There was 18 months or so left of prison time.
Can I jump in just to give you just a little bit of a background? So I ended up doing 15 months inside the prison camp. Okay. Then I went to the Brooklyn halfway house, which then I was with general population. So I was with a couple of murderers and a couple of very tough guys. And I did about 4 months there and then 2 months on an ankle bracelet. So I was able to go to my apartment. You know, I had to check into the halfway house once a week. But I was able to do those last 6 months, combination halfway house and ankle bracelet. And the nice thing about the halfway house, not to go too far off track, you can leave for work, you can leave for the gym, you can leave for laundry. So you get, you know, you get to get out a little bit, which is nice.
Okay. And how did they differ from before you had that turning point to after?
So back to what you were saying before, like thinking about that time, and when I said there was no light at the end of the tunnel, now there was a light at the end of the tunnel, but something really, to me, interesting happened where, you know, this time that was such a burden, this prison sentence that was, it seemed too much to carry, it became a gift. Because I said, I don't have a real job. I mean, I'm working in the kitchen, but I don't have my corporate job. I've accepted that I'm getting divorced. I don't have a relationship that I have to work on. You know, I had a little bit of freedom and I said, I have nothing. I can work on myself. This time is now a gift. I have the gift of time to work on myself. And that completely changed how I looked at prison. You know, I used to, before that turning point, you know, I'd said that I was so dedicated to trying to give it meaning that I burnt myself out. What I would actually do, I denied myself small acts of kindness, like watching TV. And, you know, where we were, people used to smuggle in movies. So we had bootlegged movies that were still in the theater. We had, you know, we did have a movie night, but the movies always had to be PG. You know, no R-rated movies were allowed in, but, you know, guys would smuggle in R-rated movies. So we'd have, you know, our own movie night. I denied myself that. People would say, hey, you know, why don't you come watch? We got this movie smuggled in. No, I can't do that. And it would be reading and journaling and trying to improve myself, because I was punishing myself because I wasn't worthy of it. After those visits and after that time became a gift, you know, I burnt myself out so much. When they asked me the next time, I said, yes, I am going to watch that movie. And it was one of the best 2.5 hours I've ever had because I shut my brain off. And that's also a start of really being able to do some serious good inner work, because I wasn't beating myself up. I wasn't giving myself this penance of denying myself a small act of kindness. You know, I was extending myself. I was showing myself that I was worthy of watching TV, which maybe sounds ridiculous, but it was showing that I, you know, I'm allowed to do this. And it gave me that permission. And it was really, it was so nice. So it, you know, working out became more fun. Training my clients became more fun. Working in the kitchen. You know, we had a couple of chefs, guys, you know, who were really good. We made some pretty good food for what we had. And I realized something kind of fun. We could make whatever we wanted as long as you give the guards their share. They don't say anything.
Okay.
So we'd make some special treats for us. You know, we had General Tso's chicken. You know, we put it together with the ingredients that we have as best as we could. You know, it wasn't like getting it from a store, but it was still a treat. And it was fun to be part of that group and making something, you know, so that it did change the experience.
How were the guards in there with you all?
99% of them were really nice. You know, I mean, I have to say, in varying ranges of nice. There was one who, when he saw a new guy come in, he made a point of going up to him and to that person, introducing himself and treating us like humans. The same guard, when he saw the training I was doing, I do a lot of like HIIT kind of CrossFit-y type stuff. Mm-hmm. He brought me a tire from a junkyard so that I could do with my clients and for myself, that I could flip tires. I was like, that's
cool.
He was such a stand-up guy. And I think in life, same thing, you're always going to have a small percentile that are assholes and that are jerks. And, you know, we had a few of them and you just knew to stay away from them. But for the most part, everybody was, they were pretty darn good.
That's good.
That's good.
So let's get to release. You knew you got 3 months early. You've been out halfway house and whatever. How was that integration period when you come out?
The integration period, the halfway house was really, I was fortunate. I got a job at a gym. You know, I have a court order barring me from my old industry. Yeah. And one of my friends inside prison was friends with the owner of a gym. And he said, Craig's getting out. Can you hook him up with a job? And the guy hooked me up with a job. So I was able to get out of the house for that. And that integration, that was very difficult in the beginning, because it goes back to that scarlet letter that I said that I had. You know, I'm coming from a halfway house, Federal Bureau of Prison halfway house, to come to work. And I work the front desk, so it's very social. People are coming in and out and they're like, oh, hey, you're new. My name's Dan. Nice to meet you. And I'm like, hey, Dan, how are you? And I, you know, where are you from? And I didn't know how to answer it. I didn't know what to say. And it was very difficult in the beginning, but it turned out to be one of the greatest jobs, because of that social interaction forced me to integrate more. And it allowed me to find my voice again and, you know, really start stepping into being social again. In the beginning, it was a difficult integration process. I'll never forget going to the drugstore for the first time, trying to buy shampoo and conditioner. And I was completely overwhelmed. You know, I wasn't even away that long. But walking in, the store was so bright and it was so loud and I couldn't find anything. And I was like, I was lost. And I was quite honestly a little bit scared, because I had to get back to the halfway house in a certain amount of time. I said, I don't want to be late and I'm screwing up. I'm already screwing up. And like, it took a while to integrate. And then when I was done with everything, it was May 9th, 2016, when I was done with the Federal Bureau of Prisons. And that was such a liberating day, because I could live in my apartment. I could go to supermarkets. I started what's called supervised release, which is essentially probation in the federal system here in the States. That was 3 years, but at least I was as free as I had been for a long time. And I'll tell you, Alex, this is going to sound possibly crazy, but like the first time I entered my apartment, I was entering my apartment, which was unbelievable. I got to take a shower without shoes on. you know, because you have to wear shoes in prison. Oh, okay. You know, you're not, you know, you're not going barefoot in a prison shower. It's just not gonna happen. So I get to, you know, go barefoot, and I get to walk barefoot through my apartment, and that was just so much freedom, and it felt so incredible to be able to do that. Then when I leave my apartment, you know, I stopped at my front door of my apartment building, and I looked to the right and I looked to the left, and I was like, I can literally choose which direction I go. I have a choice. And just these small freedoms that we take for granted, all of them came streaming in. And it's stuff that now I treasure.
And how did you manage to keep a relationship, a friendship with the friends beforehand, your wife and your father and stuff? Is that, do you still talk in that now? Or
my family, as a result of this, our relationship has grown closer than it's ever been. My family is nothing short of extraordinary through everything. They were above and beyond, unbelievably amazing. And I do really think we were closer than we've ever been. And I can't say how grateful I am for that. My wife and I have not spoken for many, many years. You know, and I don't know if we ever will. I think that it might be nothing. I don't want to say irreparable, because I think anything can happen. But right now, my state of mind is that it's irreparable.
Yeah, sure. So what do you call yourself again as a job? What do you call yourself?
It's a reinvention architect.
I love that. That's catchy. So explain that to people.
So that is, so I'm a coach, you know, I'm essentially, I'm a coach, and I literally work with people. You know, I have some clients who have been through the prison system and are dealing with all the shame that comes with that. It's hard to say because I work with so many different people, but it's people who want to start over, who, you know, I have one person, she's already successful, but she wants to become a coach and wants to literally architect her life and wants to start this brand new endeavor. So I work with people on mindset stuff behind that. You know, it's going to be, what is it that you want to do? What blocks are you facing? What limiting beliefs do you have? And we work through those so that they can reinvent and recreate their lives. And it's just been, you know, it's the culmination of 6 years of working on myself and being able to take everything that I experienced and use it as a tool to help others has been amazing. And it's just so much, you know, coaching came to me in a way. I've written a book. I'm currently looking for an agent for it. I knew that I wanted to do paid speaking gigs. You know, I was like, I want to share my story so that I can help people. And I want my book to get out there so that I can help people. And so I hired a business coach. She's a mindset business coach. She's unbelievable. She's amazing. And as we're working through all of our stuff, I would take what I learned from her, and a very dear friend of mine was starting her own business, and I would apply what I learned for myself, and I would work with my friend on it. And I realized how much I love doing this. I said, this is so much fun to watch these changes and to watch somebody evolve and to know that I can facilitate that. So finally, I said to my coach, I said, you know, I think I really know what it is I want to do. I still want to be an author. I still want to be a speaker, but I want to be a coach. And she was so happy. She goes, my job as a coach is, I can't tell you what you're supposed to do. She goes, but I've been waiting months for you to come to that conclusion.
Yeah.
So I'm so happy. And then it was like, what kind of coach do you want? What kind of coach do you want to be? I said, you know, I don't know. And I've got a ton of routines that I do throughout my day. But one of them is I ask my subconscious mind a question before I go to sleep, and I write it down. So I asked myself, what kind of coach, how do I want to help people? And I asked myself that, and I repeat it as I'm drifting off to sleep. And when I wake up in the morning, I repeat the question to myself. And I tell you, a good 4 to 5 times out of the week, the question comes to me crystal clear. It just comes. And it came to me and said, you've spent the past 6 years reinventing your life. Help people reinvent their lives.
Yeah.
And that's how it all began.
When it makes complete sense. Yeah. Yeah. I think coaching as well, for me, it's very often, depending on the type of coaching that you're doing, it's like a destructive process as well, rather than, because people often come to myself sometimes and say, I want to build this and I want to create this. And I say, you need to get rid of everything first. Not physically get rid of everything, but physically get rid of everything. Then you're at a place where you can start manifesting this into the world, you know.
You hit it on the head, and I think it ties back to what we were saying before about the onion. It's the peeling away. It's the taking away. And I think that's what so much of the work that you do, that I do, and that we do for ourselves and with our clients, it is that peeling away. It's stripping away. It's not adding things. We don't need to add more things. We need to strip things to get to that essence.
I've written an article about the personal development industry.
I read it.
And my issues with it. And that was one of them, because it's all about going out there, grabbing, you know, life by the scruff of the neck and going mental. And for me, it's, wait, let's go in first. Let's see where our energies are all off and let's bring everything back into alignment. Then let's go back out, because you're going to create a lot more in alignment with yourself. And I think that's missing, to be fair. It is in the UK. I don't know so much in the US, but it definitely is in the UK.
Your article totally resonated with me. I loved it for exactly that reason. I think it is that way in the US. And I think, I believe in your article, you mentioned this. I mean, it's harder to monetize going within. You know, having all the seminars, having all the externals and things like that, it's easier to monetize. And I think that's sad.
Yeah, you can't charge people to meditate. You can't charge people to tell them to sit in the corner of a room and not do anything.
Exactly. Exactly right. And it's, you know, so we've got to figure out, you know, or not we, but the self-help industry has to, you know, figure out a way to monetize those things. And I think it's such the same for all the books. You know, somebody comes up with a system that worked for them, and, you know, then they proselytize it to everybody else. And I get that. When we find something that works for us, we do want to share it with people, but it's, you know, the ABC system or whatever, you know, I'm just making up a name, but it's like, you have to do this and you are going to get these results. And when I was in prison, I was reading all these books, you know, I would try it for like 3 days, 4 days, and I would fail miserably because it just didn't resonate. And to your point that you said, I hadn't done any of the stripping away work, hadn't done any of the getting to the core and really getting to the crux of why I made the choices I made and what is the life I want to live and what limiting beliefs do I have that are preventing me from getting there. You know, I just figured I could follow this, you know, 10-step process and it was going to be the silver bullet. And it just, and I think that's such a crummy part about the self-help industry, is that it makes such large promises that if you follow this routine, you're going to find the extraordinary life. And when people don't get that extraordinary life because that it worked for that person, you know, that system works for that person. It's not, we're all different and unique. Mm. We've got to do that inner work to get through those challenges and to get to the blocks and find our energies, like you said, and put them in alignment so that we can manifest, so that we can do those things and know who we really are. And, you know, I think
that's the answer. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think I think it's possible to create on the outside what would look like an extraordinary life, lots of money. I mean, I did it, you know, I had all that, but I was empty on the inside. And it's, you know, if you, for example, if somebody makes $1 million a year, you know, on paper, a lot of people would go, oh my God, that sounds fantastic. That's amazing. If he hates waking up every single morning, that's not a success.
No.
If somebody's making $50,000 a year and they can't wait to get out of bed in the morning and they're jumping out of bed and they got a smile on their face, that's a success. You know, I mean, it's.
Yeah. I think the individual is very often now overlooked for like a hive mindset. And if you poke your head above that parapet now, very often it gets chopped off. And I think that the Siddhartha Road, I call it the Siddhartha as a metaphor, like the Buddha, the Buddhist Siddhartha Road, where you walk your own individual path. That's the only way that human beings can truly become self-fulfilled, is by walking that road. Because, for example, if you go down the religious routes, the Buddhas, the Jesuses, Muhammad and whatever, they don't follow everyone. They actually do usually the complete opposite to what everybody's doing.
Right.
And that's right. And that's why society hates, the collective mindset hates anybody usually who is tall poppy syndrome. And you have to have that courage and the wisdom, because that's the big one, having wisdom to actually bring it out into the world. Because obviously a lot of the people who try these things, that they have no wisdom. They have intellect, but not enough wisdom. Not that I'm wise beyond words, but it's just something that I can see around me in the world.
Well, I think wisdom is often overlooked, and we romanticize intellectualism. And I think, you know, given the choice between the two, I'd rather be wise.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, personally, I would rather be wise. And I'm curious, what do you think to walk that individual path, to pop your head out of the hive, that why do so few people do that? What do you think is the reason so few people venture out on that?
I think that we've been conditioned, particularly over the last 2,000 years, that that's not a good thing to do. And I think we've got generational trauma that if we do that, we're going to hell, or, you know, religious context, we're going to hell. In a personal development sense, it's like, right, we're going to go to a property seminar. So it's all property. And if I'm going to email marketing, it's all email marketing. It's just clumped. That's in the modern context. So I think it's all just a condition. And until you peel that condition, it's an impossibility to walk through. This is why I love astrology and things like that, because everything's unique and everything's individual, like the tarot and stuff. Everything's different for everybody. Whereas if you go to, as we've talked about, the personal development, it's all the same crap being chucked out all the time. But in TEDx and things like that, I prefer those, because people like yourself, that can tell the story. And your stories, you're a great storyteller, by the way, but your stories are like metaphors, and you can put into your psychology the metaphor, what that's giving you as an individual, rather than what the hive is grabbing onto. And so all you've got to do is look around you today in the world. That is one big beehive. That's all it is. And anybody who says anything different gets, you're like this, you're like this. And it's just not true.
Right. It is completely a hive mentality. And I think there's also, it's the conditioning, and it's that, I think there's a little bit of that also, which is conditioning, but the tribe mentality. Mm. You know, we don't want to get kicked out of the tribe, because you get kicked out of the tribe, you're not going to be protected when the lion comes. You're not going to, where are you going to get your food? Who's going to care for your children when you're going out hunting? You know, we haven't done these things in God knows how long, but to get kicked out of the tribe. And I honestly think that is using, let's say, public speaking. The number one fear in the world is, I believe, public speaking. And my thought on that is, it's, we fear getting judged for getting kicked out of the tribe. That we have this instinctual belief that we're going to starve and die to death if we fail on stage.
Yeah.
And that's walking our own path and popping our head up out of the hive is the equivalent of all of that. It is scary. Mm. But then once you're out there for a little bit, it's just that pure peace and calm and fulfillment and purpose. You know, I think that is just so enriching, you know, to live a full life.
I think that is one of the most important things you can do in life, is overcome that fear of other people's opinion.
It's one of the biggest challenges. But once you do, there is such a freedom on the other side of it. There was in Tara Brach's book, Radical Acceptance. It's a phenomenal book. I found it. Tim Ferriss is a huge proponent of this book. But she mentions one of the Jakarta Tales, which is the Buddha's lives before he became the Buddha. And it tells the story of this merchant who's tending his shop, and he looks across the courtyard and he sees the most luminous fabulous human being he's ever seen. And he said, I have to go meet this person. I have to go be service to this individual. So he grabs some juice and puts together a fruit tray and some dates and, you know, all that stuff. And he starts walking across the courtyard, and Mara comes busting in and starts screaming, "This is not the way for you. This is, who do you think you are? This is not your path. How dare you do this?" Lightning bolts coming from the sky. Fire is coming out from the ground, and the shopkeeper keeps on walking, and he walks, and he ignores all those voices, and he makes it to the enlightened one. And the enlightened one says to him, "Well done. If you walk through all the fears and fires in life, you will find freedom like you have never experienced before." And I'm paraphrasing. It's written much, much more beautifully than I just said. But, you know, when I read that, and I think it ties to what we were saying, it's just, it is stepping out of those bounds and trying the new things and realizing that the freedom that lies on the other side of doing it. You know, and I'm not going to sit here and say that I face every single fear that I have. You know, exactly. I still fail regularly, you know, quite a bit, but just knowing that it's there.
It's the realization that you're being controlled by it. As soon as you know that, you can become aware of it and just work with it. That's, you know, it's there. You know, it's there to serve you as the ego.
Just right.
But you don't have to listen to it just because it's there.
That I think is such the huge differentiator is you don't have to listen to it. And I think that is, you know, how to get to that point is such a part of the journey, because that voice, it's the voice that we've heard since inception in a way, when, you know, when the ego really, you know, starts kicking in. How do you ignore that voice? It's so prevalent, and it's like, well, it's gotten me to this point. Now I'm going to ignore it.
Yeah.
And, you know, but that's where the real growth comes in.
It is. I mean, and if, like Christians, for example, if you change the word Satan for your mind, you get a lot more from the Bible than you will without, by just putting him as a deity, because it's the same thing.
Right.
That little whisper that's going on, you know, don't do that. You should be scared, really. Don't, make sure you don't do it. It's just trying to hold you back. And it says, it talks about Jesus going into the desert and dealing with, and Satan spoke to him. What's that mean? I'm not bashing Christians or whatever, but I'm saying let's become more aware of what's actually being told to us here, because these books are wise, full of wisdom, and we just need to read them properly.
I agree with that 100%. I love so much of the old texts, the ancient texts. I haven't read the Bible, I'll be honest, but I love a lot of the Vedic philosophy, and I'm a huge fan of Stoicism. And it's just like the secrets to living, I think, just a fulfilling life were written thousands upon thousands of years ago. And a lot of, you know, I know that I'm not saying anything new, but I think it's my story and how I'm able to contextualize, to your point before, using it as a metaphor. You know, I know I'm not original. It's just, I have a unique story that I can share to get to a lot of those points that were already written thousands upon thousands of years ago.
Yeah.
And I think there's just so much, you know, on my desk right now, I've got Meditations by Marcus Aurelius looking at me.
Yeah. I've got that there as well. Yeah.
Yeah. I've got the Bhagavad Gita as well. You know,
yeah. But it's all been written for us. And as you say, there's nothing new under the sun. It's just how we process that. Cause we're all Ram Dass. I don't know if you know Ram Dass. I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. He said, we're all just walking each other home. And I know it's a bit fluffy and everything, and I'm very not fluffy and quite direct, but that's very true. It's back to the onion again. That peeling of the onion is you walking each other home, you get back to the same place.
Yeah. Yeah. That is, I'm actually friends with somebody who had the opportunity to sit down with Ram Dass a few times. Friends with an older guy, he's 75, 76 years old. And just to hear him tell the stories about Ram Dass, it's just really fun. And Wayne Dyer as well.
Yeah. Five or six years he passed away, I think, something like that.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I've got Be Here Now is actually right on my table, right over to my left.
Yeah. Have you ever done any work with like plant medicines or anything?
So I was... With the meditation I've done, I also do a two-stage pranayama breath work with a practitioner. So I've been doing that for over a year. I do immersion therapy in the float tanks. And the reason I mention all this stuff is it's opened my eyes to how much more is out there that I know. So before lockdown, I had found a place here in the States that I could do ayahuasca. And I had spoken to a couple of friends about doing it. They were on board with doing it, and they had the place that we were going to do it. They had an opening at the end of April. And, you know, we were like, we should do this. We should do this. And I said, you know, I'm going to do it. And then lockdown hit. So I haven't had an opportunity to do it, but I do want to experiment with ayahuasca. And psilocybin also is very intriguing to me. Mm-hmm. How about you? Have you?
Yes, I have numerous times, yeah, ayahuasca. Okay. If she's called, go and do it. Yeah. If she's called, but if she hasn't, definitely don't.
I was feeling the call. I was definitely feeling.
Yeah, she whispers to you, yeah.
So whenever you know, we get back to a new normal, we'll see what that looks like, and I'll get back to looking into that.
Cool. Well, that's been about an hour 40 minutes, I think. We've gone a long time there.
We have. This was an absolute pleasure, Alex. Thank you so much. You asked phenomenal questions.
Oh, thank you. Have you enjoyed it?
Oh, unbelievably so. I mean, seriously, you do. You ask really insightful, great questions. And I really appreciate. And also the direction that you took us was awesome.
So thank you very much.
This was great.
Is there any books that have had the biggest impact on your life? Which one would it be?
Do I have to narrow it down to one, or can I give you three or five?
Three or five.
Let's do As a Man Thinketh by James Allen. Man's Search for Meaning, yep. Viktor Frankl. Meditations, Marcus Aurelius. The Bhagavad Gita. And I would say Live Your Truth by Kamal Ravikant.
I haven't read that one.
He's a friend of mine, actually. Okay. I met him as a result of my prison experience. And he's an amazing guy. He's got every single one of his books is I love them. I love the way he writes. I love his cadence. He uses very simple words and says so much. You know, nothing is about his ego. He gets to the point and says so much in so few words. And I really appreciate that.
That's beautiful, yeah. That's an art form.
It is. Mm.
Right. Thank you very much for coming on. We're going to wrap this thing up. So thank you.
Alex, thank you so much.
Cheers, Craig. All the best.
All the best to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.